Welcome to The Healthy Advisor, a podcast from wealthmanagement.com focused on advisors' personal well-being and healing. I'm Diana Britton, managing editor of wealthmanagement.com, and in this podcast, we explore some of the struggles and personal development issues facing advisors and financial services professionals, and how to get to a place of healing for mind, body, and spirit. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Healthy Advisor podcast, and thanks for joining us. As you may know, this is the podcast focused on financial advisor health and well-being, and today's guest cares very much about this topic. Her name is Cheryl Canzanella. She's a retirement solutions partner at Movement Mortgage and a past president of NAIFA Northeast Florida. Cheryl, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So in August 2017, Cheryl lost her husband to an accidental overdose. And so she's been exposed firsthand to the horrific realities of the opioid crisis. And since his death, she's made it her mission to educate employers and her peers in the financial services industry on how the opioid epidemic is not only ripping families apart emotionally, but also financially by diminishing careers, draining financial assets, and crushing retirement dreams. And so, Cheryl, I just want to start by, you know, telling me a little bit about your journey with your first husband. How did you meet him?
So I love our story. We actually met in elementary school, although we didn't know it at the time. And when we became friends, we were 15, 16 years old, and completely different part of the county that we lived in. And we actually worked together at a grocery store. And over the years, we maintained a very good, close friendship. And at some point, we figured out that we went to elementary school together in some other part of the county. And it wasn't until we started dating that it was actually before our engagement party. It was a day before, and we found the picture of us standing side by side, holding our elementary school flag together. And so it's a story where we have crossed paths many times and eventually, you know, fell in love and got together. So yeah, we were best friends. I mean, he was definitely somebody who I had knew as an individual before we started even dating and before we made the choice to commit our lives together. And it's interesting as you go through things like substance use disorder, it doesn't happen overnight. So going through this journey, I was in denial myself for the longest time. And then when we started to recognize it and started to address it, it still was something very gradual, and it just didn't happen suddenly. It was slow and gradual. And for all these years of knowing him as an individual, and there are all the many reasons why I fell in love with him, you see a change in someone and they become a completely different person. He started with a prescription for pain that ultimately led him down this unforgiving path that he was not able to steer himself out of. It was pretty difficult to go through when you're ready to start a life together, build a family, and start to live together and build your life. Yeah, it was pretty troubling times that we had going through his substance use disorder. And all the while, I've been in the financial industry for 25 years to this day. And at the time, which is about 6 years ago, so 18, 19 years in the financial industry, this was definitely not something that I wanted anyone to know for a number of different reasons, not just the shame and stigma that comes along with addiction, but it was also because I'm helping people with their financial futures. And here I am barely able to hold my head above water. And I'm in business for myself, making the most money I've ever made in my life. And it was It was troubling to be able to share with anybody that I was going through this, because how could I help you with your retirement and your financial future if I can't help my own?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I want to talk a little bit more about that later, but what were some of the signs that you noticed that he was addicted?
Wow. The signs, the red flags. So there were so many. I mean, it starts to become, you know, they go through manipulation and lies, and you start to uncover that, and the trouble with money and not being able to hold a job. Those are all the typical signs that a lot of people come across. And what I realized too, or there was a lot of other signs, especially financially. And we were spending more money on, you know, takeout or delivery versus cooking at home. We were spending money on getting his truck fixed, things that as we are putting together budgets, you wouldn't normally have to, you'd be more mindful of your spending in these areas, but it kind of goes right out the door. So I would say spending was a huge red flag. The lies and the manipulation were right along with it. So that those were the biggest red flags, I would say, that jump out at me.
Yeah. And what, I mean, tell us about what happened in the days leading up to his death and on the day that he passed.
So he had gone through recovery several times, treatment centers and recovery centers, and it just wasn't clicking for him. And I'll tell you, he absolutely did not want this. I can be honest, he probably hated his life, and it's definitely not what he wanted for his family. And but he couldn't stay in those rehabs and the treatment centers, or they just weren't working for him. And at the time, we were in a good area. He was getting better. He was not 100%. He was still drinking. And I believe when I was out of town, and he was by himself. And I think that was the hardest thing, is that he was all alone. He didn't have myself or someone there to support him. And he relapsed. And so I was driving home, and I couldn't get in touch with him, and wasn't unusual. But I was a little concerned, and yeah. I started to panic because of all of the other times of relapsing, and you realize, okay, you can't get in touch with them. What are you going to do? You start searching everywhere. And so it's exactly what I started to do. I started searching, driving around, and eventually I called the hospital, and that's how I found out, was making the call, the proactive call to reach out to the hospital.
So did it happen at home? He was at home, and how did he get to the hospital?
So my understanding of it was that he was actually in my car. He was not in his truck, and I can't remember exactly why, but he was in my car, and I guess he was with other people. And as he went through the overdose, they took off. When I actually back up, I believe, just piecing things together, we thought they took off and left him.
Okay.
But when you read the reports and his autopsy and his chest, and it actually, and then I hear there was reports of people seeing people fighting, but they weren't fighting. What we think happened is that they dragged him out of the car and started pounding on his chest, and were trying to do their best to revive him, and then got spooked for whatever reason and ran away. We believe that they probably tried to help him. And then when someone called the cops, eventually the cops came there because they thought there was a fight. And ultimately when the ambulance came, they took him to the hospital. Yeah. They instead of getting help immediately that there's an issue, you know, he wasn't able to make it.
Gosh, I'm so sorry. I mean, I know it's difficult to rehash those moments. So I wanted to provide a little bit of context about the opioid crisis in America. You know, and it's a lot more prevalent than people might think. According to the CDC, The number of people who died from a drug overdose in 2021 was over six times the number in 1999. The number of drug overdose deaths increased more than 16% from 2020 to 2021. Over 75% of the nearly 107,000 drug overdose deaths in 2021 involved an opioid. And from 2020 to 2021, opioid-involved death rates increased by over 15%. Prescription opioid-involved death rates remained the same. Heroin-involved death rates decreased nearly 32%. Synthetic opioid-involved death rates, excluding methadone, increased over 22%. I mean, that's a couple of years ago, so I don't know what it is, what the numbers are today. But I mean, tell me about how you felt in the days and weeks after his death.
I was incredibly angry. I was angry for a lot of things, angry at addiction, angry at him, angry at people around him that influenced him. I was angry at the pharmaceutical companies. And I found a lot of peace and I felt a connection with him after he passed, that in a sense that helped me get through that time. And to take that anger and release it. And an opportunity came about that just happened to be my friend is a producer for a local TV station, and they just happened to be doing a special on the opioid epidemic. And of course, she wasn't going to ask me to anything about it. And she was close friends with us and my husband. But someone told me about it, and I reached out to her, and I told her if she needs anything, just to let me know. And next thing you know, a week later, I was taping a promo. She used my words. I had a notebook I had written down over the years, and she had taken my words and put them all together and made a short 30-second commercial that she thought was just going to be used for the internet promotions. And ultimately, they ran it on the TV and for the entire episode, which was taking place over the next few weeks. And so all of a sudden, it became public. And I knew that going into it. And I felt very empowered to help other people at that point, because not only did it help me to share my husband and help people understand who he really was, not how he left us. It helped me to realize that other people are experiencing the same thing. My story is not unique, and it gave me an opportunity to educate the world that this happens to everyday people, not the stigma that we generally have in our minds. And when we close our eyes and we think about a person going through substance use or opioid use disorder or addiction, it's not that person that's sitting out on the corner, not just that person sitting out on the corner of the street or, an abandoned building or, sleeping on a mattress. It's our neighbors, it's our friends, family, coworkers. People that ride the bus with us in the morning, or the people that we see at Starbucks when we're having coffee. It's everyday people that are going through this, and that's where I found my voice to be able to help others, educate others on what this epidemic is. Those numbers you mentioned are staggering, and they are terrifying when you think about over 100,000 people dying last year from addiction alone. And almost 70% of them were from opioid, had an opioid involved part of that overdose. This is definitely impacting our lives, and it is crisis that is ultimately undeniable that we're facing. So it's impacting all of us.
It is a topic that is rarely discussed in the financial services industry, right? But it impacts families financially in a significant way. How did it impact you financially, your family?
Yeah, so financially, outside of the addiction itself, there's a lot of financial burden from the drug use itself, but the other implications that come along with it, not necessarily in our case, but you've got legal issues, potentially criminal issues. So it extends beyond just the drug use, but for us personally, we had not only we were making poor financial decisions for our own lives, but we increased our spending, credit card debt. We had loss of income because he wasn't working. So I was not only the head of the household, and I was the breadwinner, but I was the only income earner. And medical emergencies that pop up. That happened often. Things like the treatment and recovery. So while you're going through recovery, you also that the costs don't stop after the addiction, even as you're going through recovery. The for us personally, we it was difficult to navigate our health insurance. And there was a time when we didn't have health insurance. When he wanted to get help, and when someone going through this asks for help, you stop and do everything you can immediately to help them. And we immediately brought him to a treatment center, and I couldn't navigate insurance, and we paid about $15,000, maybe more, out of pocket for him to stay less than 28 days. So you add that up and those costs of recovery and treatment, which it may take multiple treatment and years to go through recovery. And that number can add up pretty quickly.
I mean, I have a family member who has an addiction problem, and it's just an everyday struggle. It's not like it, you go through treatment and that's it. What, and I know you were telling me that for some families, they are not really thinking about, how they're going to pay for it or where the money's going to come from or what the tax implications are. They just do it quickly, right? Because they want to, it's an urgent issue and they want to get this person help, right? I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've had people I've spoken to that have lost their children, and they didn't go into detail. One family in particular, they didn't go into detail about their struggles, but she said to me that they spent over $100,000 trying to get their son treatment. I don't know what financial position she was in. Was $100, $100,000 a lot to her? For many families, you could say that would be true. Does it knock her off her own retirement plan and what they were saving within their lifetime? Was it their entire savings? Did they liquidate assets in order to get this recovery? But her son passed away from overdose not long after my husband did. And I can tell you, in our conversation, if I was to ask her, if her son was here today, she probably would spend every single penny she has just to have him alive with us here today.
Yeah, of course.
So, of course. And so people are going, they're desperate. They are going through their own crisis and anything that they could do to help their children or their loved ones. And again, like I said in the beginning, it doesn't happen overnight. So gradually this starts to add up. And once you start to add up just the valuable contributions that you're not making to maybe things like retirement or your savings or investments, and then having adequate health insurance coverage, whether or not you have the coverage, are you paying out of pocket, all of this starts to really add up. So those costs, I don't think you can put a number on a life saved. However, more education should be out there on how they could access certain, how they could have access to their funds to be able to provide treatment to their loved ones. So, for example, you wouldn't want someone in crisis mode who is making cloudy financial decisions just to pull money out of a qualified account where they're going to be hit with taxes and penalties for early distribution. If they're working with someone that could guide them, like an advisor or a planner, that could advise them on which direction to access the money. Because honestly, I don't think you're going to tell them not to take the money out when they're in desperation mode. But we could maybe help guide them to the most efficient way to access their money, or maybe create more liquidity for them to access money for emergencies that happen to pop up very often. So being able to have someone to help guide you is key during that time. But most people like myself aren't going to share with you that they're in that crisis mode.
Yeah. Tell us about the work that you're doing now to bring awareness to this issue in the financial services industry.
Yeah. So when I spoke on TV or my video was aired on TV, I found my voice and the first industry I wanted to share this education to was my peers in the financial industry, because I knew how much it had hit us financially and I wanted to educate them. And what I realized is many financial advisors in our industry or financial professionals in our industry are aware that there's an issue out there, but like many, they may not think it happens to their clients. They may not think that their clients are going through it. And if they do have a couple clients, that's probably about it. But the reality is right now, as you mentioned with those numbers, we have 3 million people out there with just opioid use disorder alone. So they are going through opioid addiction with prescription drugs, at prescription-based opioids. Then you have 11 million people that are misusing them and are at risk for addiction. It's very highly likely that you have clients going through some sort of crisis that is involving either illicit or legal prescription drugs. And so being able to educate my peers on what we went through personally, and that, hey, I am a professional in this industry. I have an education. I have been in the financial services industry at that point, 18, 19 years. This can happen to anyone. And so what I did is I started to speak out on it, and I had an opportunity just recently to partner with the state of Ohio, who unfortunately, Ohio is one of many states that have been hit pretty hard by this epidemic and continues to fight this battle. And I was able to partner with their securities commissioner to put out and create a course dedicated to educating the financial industry on substance use disorder in general, but also opioids, and how to help have the conversation with your clients, as well as understanding some of those red flags you asked about earlier, with some strategies to help them through that process. So it's really the first of its kind in the industry, because I don't believe companies right now are educating their advisors on the epidemic, which at some point I believe is going to be part of maybe their firm element training or some kind of training that they can give and provide to advisors to help them through working with their clients on this epidemic.
Yeah, and the Ohio program is great. It's we've written about it. It's one of the nation's first statewide initiatives focusing on financial advisors' role in curtailing the opioid epidemic, and hopefully other states will look to that as a model and come up with similar programs. I know we talked a little bit about some of the red flags, but I'm just wondering, just more generally, like, what are some of the red flags that someone may have a loved one who's addicted?
You know, it's such, this reaches such a, this is so far reaching and is hitting people at all different age levels. And we typically will think of younger individuals, those 45, 55 years old. And then, of course, the kids now growing up, high school and college. So it impacts families in general, but don't forget, we also have an elderly population and seniors that are also being impacted from this. They are not only falling victim to things like financial fraud, but they are also being manipulated and taken advantage of. So seniors use opioids to manage their own chronic pain and help them with their own pain symptoms and maybe cancer and help them live a more comfortable life. But they are just as susceptible to addiction as anyone else. And for seniors, that looks a little bit different on what those red flags could be. But it's important to realize that they may be experiencing the same problems with the drugs as others as well. And we talk about financial fraud. I mean, we know that there's, I don't know if it was 30 billion or 35 billion a year that are impacting seniors falling victim of financial fraud. So people could be trying to steal from them. They may be, oftentimes it's family members and from within. So if the seniors are not addicted themselves, they may be trying to be manipulated, or they may have their drugs stolen directly from them, and they may not even be receiving the pills that you think that they should have or they are being prescribed. Those are some of the red flags for seniors, but when we can even take this a step further outside of families and business owners, and businesses themselves. They say that 75% of businesses have been impacted by opioid-related issues, and that could be anything from healthcare costs to productivity, having to rehire individuals, and retrain, and the cost to continuously try to bring on people within the workforce. And that can include accidents or people not showing up to work. So the bottom line for businesses, that that's a whole nother area that could require a lot of attention, because businesses are also being impacted as well as individuals.
I mean, there's just a huge wide-reaching impact of this. I know, so Cheryl, I know you've gotten remarried since his death. I know you had a baby boy, I think. You have a baby boy now. And you know, congratulations on that. Where are you at now, I guess, and in terms of healing from, you know, your first husband's death and just all the stuff you went through during that time? Have you found, do you feel like you've found healing, and how so?
Well, certainly I did work on myself and took time for myself. The healing came as I continued to realize my connection with him. Although he's not here physically, I feel like we're still working together to fight this. So I found a tremendous amount of healing and being able to bring my story to others, and also to be able to help others. And that took time. It still hurts. I mean, it still hurts, and still have painful memories, but and I also have some great memories. And being able to continue this work and build a business to where I can help others and help people understand what those going through this nightmare experience, and help educate and bring awareness, just, I mean, is fulfilling. And you know, I worked on myself for a number of years, and I feel very fortunate that I had an opportunity to meet someone new, and that he supports me on all of my endeavors here, and he supports the message, and that means a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, Cheryl is not getting paid, to be on this podcast or anything, or to speak out about this story. It's just something she does to help people and bring awareness to the issues that specifically this industry needs to know about around this. And so Cheryl, thank you so much. I mean, I'm afraid we're just about out of time. I'd like to thank Cheryl Canzanella for being on the podcast, for being so vulnerable and sharing this story with us. Cheryl, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, if you'd like to reach out to Cheryl, if you have any questions, you can reach her at Cheryl, CANZ at gmail.com. But you can also get more information about this issue and about the work that she's doing at opioidfinancialawareness.com and CherylCanzanella.com. That's her website. You can go there for more information. If you yourself have a struggle and you wish to share your experiences and help others in similar situations, please feel free to reach out to me at diana.britton@informa.com. I'd like to thank you for listening to The Healthy Advisor. If you've not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This is Diana Britton reminding you that where there's healing, there is hope. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to The Healthy Advisor, a podcast focused on advisors' personal well-being and healing. Click the subscribe button below to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of wealthmanagement.com. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice. Always seek the advice of your healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding your particular situation.